Random House Audio presents Root and Branch by Ron James Jr. Read for you by Dominic Hoffman. Chapter 1 Southern Justice on Trial. The fox hunting set of Loudoun County, Virginia had been on edge for weeks, even before the two women were found murdered. With alarming ease, burglars had been stealing china, jewels, and even furniture from the Georgian homes scattered atop the rolling hills that lay about 40 miles northwest of Washington, D.C. No suspects had been taken into custody, and homeowners in towns like Leesburg were oiling their rifles for more than mere sport during the first weeks of 1932. On one mild January night, furniture designer Paul Boeing retired to the big house of his family's estate, where he slept warily, prepared to defend the property against any would-be intruders. Boeing awoke the next morning after an uneventful sleep, donned an overcoat atop his pajamas, slid on an old pair of shoes, and welcomed the crisp morning with a stroll across the lawn to the cottage where his sister and her maid had spent the night. His knocking went unanswered. Boeing opened the door, stepped into the cottage, and jumped back outside as if thrown by a man twice his size. His sister, Agnes Boeing Ilsley, lay beaten to death on the cottage floor. Mina Buckner, Agnes's maid, lay dead in the next room with her skull crushed and one hand stiffly clutching her set of false teeth. Investigators later found the scratched bits of a black person's hair and skin caked in blood beneath Agnes's fingernails. Before the sun struck noon that day, a band of white men had swarmed through several towns in Loudoun County searching for the man they were convinced had murdered the socially prominent Miss Ilsley and her maid. Despite the fact that several of the men were well-to-do members of the county's gentry, their group comprised a lynch mob. They planned to find the murderer, torture him, castrate him, and kill him. But by nightfall it had become clear to them that they were not going to find the killer. It would be more than a year before they learned that the man they sought, George Crawford, was arrested in Boston. It would be another year before the Loudoun County Courthouse resonated for the first time with the voice of an African-American lawyer rising in defense of Crawford, by then formally accused of murdering the two women. And it would be a few months after that when a writer for the Washington Post declared, "If there ever was a lucky Negro, he is George Crawford." In 1932, the chief executive of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People had straight blonde hair and blue eyes, a thick mustache, and a thin man's tendency to disappear inside double-breasted suits. By all accounts, Walter White looked Caucasian. "My skin is white," he wrote on the first page of his autobiography. "My eyes are blue, my hair is blonde. The traits of my race are nowhere visible upon me." The mailman's son could have passed out of the colored world and lived his life as a white man. If he and his father had not been attacked by a white mob during the Atlanta race riots of 1906, perhaps he would have crossed over like thousands of African Americans did each year. But Walter was 13 years old on that searing September night when Atlanta burned anew, when he and his father defended their home against a mob of white men wielding fire and yelling, "That's where that nigger mail carrier lives. Let's burn it down." Gunshots scattered the horde, and the shaken blonde boy decided that he forever would be black. 10 years later, White joined the NAACP after graduating from Atlanta University. Field Secretary James Weldon Johnson, impressed with White's volunteer efforts in the Atlanta branch, hired him as an assistant field secretary. The young staffer's transracial appearance quickly proved an invaluable asset. From 1918 to 1929, White repeatedly went undercover to mingle with Klansmen and murderers and bloodthirsty lots. Posing as a white man, he investigated 41 lynchings and 8 race riots. He publicized their stories and plans through the NAACP. For life, White was haunted by what he saw and heard during those 11 years. The fight against lynching became Walter White's crusade. He wrote several critically acclaimed books on the subject and after working his way up to become the NAACP's chief executive, he vowed to use every means at his disposal to stop the brutal killings. In his New York City office in January 1933, White read in the newspapers that a black man was arrested in Boston and had confessed to murdering two white women in rural Virginia the year before. 8 days after confessing, however, the suspect claimed that he had not killed the women and in fact had been in Boston when the crime occurred. Several witnesses substantiated his alibi. Nonetheless, authorities in Massachusetts began making arrangements to extradite the suspect, George Crawford, to Virginia. The entire affair looked to Walter White like a legally sanctioned lynching. While it could not patrol the swamps and thickets where white mobs slaughtered black men, the NAACP could stand guard against America's courtrooms becoming the sites of slaughter. George Crawford's life could be saved if the association could keep him from being extradited to Virginia. Lou Down County Prosecutor John Gallagher had rushed to Massachusetts upon word of Crawford's arrest, pausing only for his own wedding in Washington. The morning after the wedding night, Gallagher left for Boston with his bride in tow on what the Associated Press called an extradition honeymoon. After his arrest, Crawford's NAACP lawyer, led by Bostonian Butler Wilson, fought extradition on the grounds that black citizens were excluded from Virginia's juries, in violation of the 14th Amendment's guarantee of equal protection of the laws. The lawyers persuaded Federal Judge James A. Lowell, and he ordered Crawford released. Why send this man back to Virginia when I know, and everyone knows, the Supreme Court will say his trial is illegal? The judge demanded. The lawyers are the only ones who will get anything out of it. The whole thing is absolutely wrong. Virginia appealed, with its attorney general exclaiming, "Why, under Lowell's ruling, it would be illegal to try any colored person before a Virginia jury for any offense." Likewise, infuriated by his professed reliance on Yankee common sense, Congress impeached Judge Lowell, who suddenly fell sick. 10 days later, the 64-year-old judge died in Newton, Massachusetts. The Circuit Court of Appeals overturned Lowell's ruling. It held that because Virginia did not by statute exclude African Americans from jury service, its juries were constitutionally sound. Whether or not black people ever actually served on Virginia's juries was irrelevant. Crawford's attorneys appealed to the Supreme Court, but the justices declined to hear the case. The 32-year-old black man was returned to Lou Down County to stand trial for capital murder. Before returning to Virginia with his bride, Gallagher spoke of the defendant to the press. "We want to give him plenty of time to get counsel and otherwise prepare his defense, but court is in session now and I see no reason for delay." Gallagher pointedly added, "I will recommend that Crawford be placed in the Alexandria jail in lieu of being brought to Leesburg in advance of the trial." Alexandria was 2 counties east of Leesburg. Loudoun County's prosecutor was afraid that Crawford, like so many black defendants held in southern jails, would be kidnapped and lynched if he spent a night in the Leesburg jail. With George Crawford destined for trial and the nation now interested in his fate, Walter White was more determined than ever to save Crawford's life. As perhaps the most well-connected black man in the nation, White had his pick of America's most accomplished progressive attorneys to represent the suddenly famous defendant. The man at the top of his list was the dean of the Howard University School of Law and a graduate of Amherst College and Harvard Law School. His tireless work and controversial decisions had elevated the school from one that accepted high school graduates to one fully accredited by the American Bar Association. But Charles Hamilton Houston promptly replied with his regrets. "This case is far too big to be sloppily prepared. I would not be equal to the task," Houston explained, "because it would mean that I would have to give up all work here at the university. It would be impossible to do both jobs at the same time." The school year had already begun by October 1933, and it was too late for the dean to apply for a leave of absence. Before signing off, however, Houston conceded that, if Crawford could be tried by all Negro counsel, it would be a turning point in the legal history of the Negro in this country. Walter White was nothing if not perceptive. He knew that Charlie Houston did not write incidentally.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?